Hey guys, if you want updates on our latest episodes, then be sure to subscribe to the Film Colossus podcast on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen. Also, if you'd like to support the show and hear episodes ad-free, then subscribe to our Patreon page at patreon.com/filmcolossus.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's Byte.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte. My name is Chris Lambert.
And my name is Travis Bean. And on today's episode, we discuss Charlotte Wells' beloved coming-of-age story, Aftersun. We dig into how the film masterfully handles such delicate subject matter and uses meta-techniques to showcase the power of memory and reflection.
I don't know what energy level to start out this episode.
I don't either, because we're in an interesting position. Chris usually doesn't know what I think about a movie. This time, I don't know what Chris thinks about a movie.
That's very true. This is one that you watched a while ago, that your first time, wrote about it, and I just watched for the first time ever.
Yeah, which I'm surprised. I feel like this movie was such a big deal in 2022. It feels like the kind of movie Chris Lambert would be a part of and have an opinion on.
Yeah, I don't know how I missed it. When did it do its U.S. premiere? It came out in October. Yeah, I was watching movies. I was writing about them. I don't know what it was.
It's heavy subject matter. So in that way, it's not the most inviting movie. But at the same time, this is the kind of movie that really, really, really speaks to people. People have formed a strong attachment to it. It reminds me of Past Lives in that way, actually.
Yeah.
So there is a vibrant energy around this movie, you know.
Yeah, I was thinking about Past Lives a lot.
Me too.
I feel like Past Lives is a bit more digestible than right. This in some ways, or a lot more obvious about what it's doing, not in a bad way. Mm-hmm. Like, there's still depth and nuance to Past Lives, certainly, but just I think people come away with a distinct understanding of what happened and why it happened and the overall themes. There's subtext, but it's more there if you really want to dive in, where I think Aftersun is a lot more reliant on subtext, and that people could come away from this movie being like, I get the father-daughter dynamic and some of the implications, but what?
Right.
What was that? What was this other thing?
Yeah, that's why I really enjoyed revisiting this movie, because that kind of was my feeling the first time I watched it. You're totally right about Past Lives and that it's very clear in what it's doing. It's not exactly hiding anything. And the movie really requires you to be there in the moment with people and to really just take in what they're saying and how they're looking at each other and the energy they're sharing. It's just something you're really a part of, and it's very intimate. Where Aftersun, not that it's not intimate, like what the filmmaker is expressing is very intimate and personal, but the way it's filmed, it feels more like an art piece or something. Like everything represents something, you know, things are not spoken out loud. There are a lot of like long looks and scenes of just things far away happening. And it's more of a mood and just this kind of, the whole movie is somebody reflecting on a pastime in their lives. So like you kind of have to look at it in that way. It's somebody like piecing something together. It's almost like the filmmaker doesn't even know what the story is about. Like they're trying to figure out what it's about too by going through this process. So in that way, Aftersun, that's why I liked revisiting it, because like I knew everything already kind of going in, and I didn't need to spend time figuring out like little details. Like I knew all that, so I could just kind of fall into the art of it and what it was trying to say artistically.
Yeah. It's definitely easy to fall into. It's very drinkable rather than being off-putting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So what was your background with this movie? Had you been hearing about it before you watched it?
Mm-hmm.
What had you heard? What were your expectations going in?
It's I think I mentioned this in the Past Lives episode that whenever it's an A24 project, I'm a little like I take my time with it. Like I choose the right moment. I don't know if while I really like A24, I like a lot of their movies. We talk about Past Lives. I love that movie. I sometimes don't connect with them in the same way everyone else seems to. And I kind of approach this movie in the same way that I didn't know if it was going to have that, because the reaction to this movie is just so strong and people really connect with it that I'm like, I kind of get nervous in the sense that, okay, like this is heavy subject matter. This is the kind of stuff that really speaks to people. So if I don't like it, I'm going to be looked at as a villain or something. But I was interested to watch it, and my wife and I watched. I probably just watched it because, you know, I'm trying to keep up. Last year, I was trying to keep up with new movies, and this was a big one. So I was like, it was just one night we chose to watch it, and watched it at home, and I really enjoyed it. It was a movie I liked more and more the more I thought about it. But it wasn't a movie that like hit me exactly the same way it seemed to hit everyone else right away. But over time, like the more I thought about it, and especially as I wrote about it for the site, like I said, it's like an art piece. Like you start to like look at different bits and pieces of the film and realize like how things connect. So in terms of like the blueprint of it, there's a lot there and there's a lot going on and there's a lot being said. And with a movie like that, it's tough because, you know, it's one of those movies where I'm like, okay, I like it in retrospect, but do I actually like watching it? Like, am I experiencing all of these different messages and ideas while it's happening and feeling it? And this time watching the movie, that was my big question. Like, am I going to be feeling all that? And I definitely did. I still don't know if I love it as much as everyone else, but I definitely see why people love it and think it's a complete work. You know, I think Everything connects in a way that I'm like, okay, like this wasn't like thrown together. This isn't like a mesh of ideas that aren't quite working. You know, everything's very delicately done and it succeeds in the end.
Yeah, I would absolutely agree with that. It's not lacking in polish in that way.
Mm-hmm.
I remember the posters. I don't know if, you know, getting real for a second.
All right.
I don't know if there was a recoiling from the movie a little bit, just because from maybe the trailer or the poster, there's just an intimation that I had or had heard that like something was going to happen to someone. And
right.
Having lost both of my parents early at, you know, 20 years old and 25 years old, I think that there was probably a part of me that was maybe a little nervous about the movie and some of the feelings that it could bring up. And maybe with that in mind, kind of pushed back from it just a little bit. So when finally watching it, after seeing how much people love this movie and still not quite knowing which direction it was going to go, I was really curious to see, because I had no idea about, you know, the style of it. I knew that people really love the performances, but I didn't have a good concept going in of what the tone was going to be, or how dramatic, not dramatic, how subtle or not subtle it was. And I was pretty surprised by how delicate it is, but also just how artistic it is in its vision. Some of the shots that it's going for are so unique. Like Charlotte Wells, I think, has a very wonderful eye for all of this. And the cinematography was done by Gregory Oakey. It's just a beautiful movie in that way. And really my pacing when it comes to shots, we've talked about that at length with me really enjoying being able to steep in some of the moments. So I enjoyed the kind of like pacing and meditation of it, and just the way in which it was able to focus on each of the characters in different ways. So I was very pleased and surprised while watching it.
Yeah, like that's all definitely true. And in that way, it feels so assured, like it's very confidently done. And because it's not easy to like steep in a moment like that. You can't just like steep in nothing. There has to be meaning and intent, and it has to be going somewhere, and you have to be learning something, and your actors have to work well together. Like a lot of stuff has to be going right for all that to work. But at the same time, like I think what I really noticed in this viewing, and I already said this, that is that it does also have that sense of a filmmaker trying to piece something together, trying to figure out something alongside you. It gives those steeping scenes just a different energy, I think. Yeah. That it kind of feels uncomfortable in that way, that like we don't really know why we're here, like not much is really being said, yet everything's being said. Like what Colm is saying right now is so important when you know in retrospect that he's gone and that Sophie can't talk to him anymore. There's just a very heavy air about it that I think makes this movie really unique. And it's not something that could really be communicated in a trailer. It's just a very interesting aesthetic that I don't think we're really used to. Like we already talked about Past Lives and how that movie has an interesting aesthetic, and maybe like on paper you could say they're similar, but they're not really similar at all. Like After Sun is like so quiet and secretive, and it's not even secretive. Again, it's just like you don't know. You don't know what's happening. Like you wish, you want these people to talk to each other. You wish Colm would tell Sophie like what he's feeling, but like he can't. He doesn't know how. It's just a very interesting aesthetic to capture for sure.
Yeah, and that piecing together, I think that's maybe the biggest difference. I mean, obviously the movies are focused on two different parts of life, Past Lives and After Sun. But in terms of tone and the confidence, like both Celine Song and Charlotte Wells are clearly very confident filmmakers with distinct artistic visions. But I think the sense I got was that Celine Song had lived this, come to terms with it, and was at a point in her life where it was the best story for her to tell as a first film, where the impression I got from Charlotte Wells was that, as you said, she is still working through some of these emotions that she might have. She had said that the movie was autobiographical, emotionally autobiographical. So I could see it having this kind of energy of trying to work through the emotions she has with, you know, her dad or a parent figure in that way, and trying to capture that, explore it, find meaning from that, and find the catharsis in it, which is essentially what we're seeing with the strobe light sequences. It's representing this adult version of Sophie trying to work her way through the darkness of understanding her father and reach him, connect with him, and find that forgiveness, that understanding, that sense of closure that she has maybe struggled with in her adult life. With the implication that he's gone, and having that be this little subplot that's pieced through it gives the movie a strangeness, because it's a defamiliarization in what is a very grounded movie to have this externalization of her internal struggle in something that's so much more fantastic than the rest of the movie can throw people. But it did feel to me like that's sort of what it was getting at, especially with the finally the embrace at the end. Mm-hmm. So we have the idea that she's watching the camera footage from the trip on her birthday, really reflecting on that day, the implications of that day, the memory of it all. And as she's watching it, we're witnessing this emotional journey she's going on to have this understanding and this catharsis and this connection with him that she kind of hopefully has at the end. It does, at least to me, seem like she's in a place of, what's the word, gratitude.
Yeah.
At the end for the time that she had with him.
Yeah. And that way it really makes me realize how much of the movie is meta, because she's, I mean, any movie using cameras like feels meta, I guess.
Yeah.
But in this movie, it literally starts with her looking at footage, and you see her reflection in the TV as she's looking at the footage, and then like the footage warps and it kind of flows into the movie, and then all of a sudden we're watching a movie. We're watching footage of this trip she took of her dad. So suddenly it goes from like this camera, this low quality footage, to like real footage. Like we're seeing it, yet at the same time, like we're not seeing it. We're seeing what director Charlotte Wells like remembers of it. Like we're seeing how she's now going to depict things. She captures all these moments of Callum that she did not see. Yeah. Moments where he's like alone and crying and like doesn't know how to express himself. Suddenly we're watching a movie of her processing this information, and then cutting back to the real footage. It's like, oh wait, like it's more than that. Like it's real. Like this did actually happen, and there are things she can see and use to piece together other things she didn't see. So in that way, it's just a really cool, I don't know if we've talked about any meta movies on the podcast yet, but like I've written about them a ton for the website. I love people like Jafar Panahi, Brian De Palma does this kind of stuff. Like I love when movies get meta. And I would say as an aficionado of meta movies, like this is a very unique way to do one.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Looking for a new high-end mascara without breaking the bank? The new L'Oreal Paris Panorama Mascara gives you a high-end lash look in a premium gold luxe packaging. It's all about panoramic volume and fully fanned out lashes. With its tapered brush, the new Panorama Mascara catches every single lash, giving you the false lash look without any of the hassle. Say goodbye to clumps and flakes, because this mascara is specially formulated to resist them all day with up to 24-hour wear. And the best part? It performs better than Luxe mascaras at only a fraction of the cost. You can buy Panorama Mascara on Amazon today.
Yeah, that mixture, because we know that it's the footage is mixing with her memory. So we're getting not only the footage as a very literal thing, but the footage also being representative of her memory. So then when the movie comes in, it's at once the memories of what happened, but also not, it's the authorial perspective, the omniscient perspective that she could it possibly have. So there's a degree of subjectivity without it becoming truly subjective in the way that, you know, Tar has subjective scenes, Oppenheimer has subjective scenes, more traditional like Fight Club, right, or American Psycho, but you're not getting quite that degree of subjectivity where like the scene of him crying is something that she's just making up in her mind.
Yeah,
it definitely happened. She wasn't privy to it. She doesn't have a memory of it necessarily, but we know that it's kind of tying in with the emotional memory that she's having. So there's just a lot of layers to what that's saying about memory, about video cameras, about the act of making a movie, based on something like this. It's in some ways similar to, not to keep coming back to Past Lives, but that opening scene of Past Lives, where you start from the perspective of the other people at the bar looking at the main trio being on the outside, and you get that direct eye contact. It's cool to have these very different filmmakers finding ways in which to address the meta aspects of what they're making, and having that idea of, you know, bringing in the vision and the perspective and the different points of view of the camera, the characters, and how that all adds these unique layers to the films.
Yeah. I mean, as you say that, you're making me realize that, and I was just sitting here looking at it, I was like, I wonder how old Charlotte Wells is. She's my age, like, exactly my age. And last time we were talking about Past Lives, and I'm like, man, this movie, like, I feel like it speaks exactly to 35-year-olds my age. How old is Celine Song? 35 years old. Like, A24 must have some research on me and my fellow companions, like, and they know the kinds of things we're going through, and they know the kinds of things that these film, I don't really think that, but it's just interesting that these filmmakers who are my age are exploring these things and these ideas in a very unique and interesting way. Like, it really feels like A24 is allowing them to do things in a different and creative way. Like, this isn't the most inviting way to make a movie necessarily, like having these meta aspects, or in Past Lives, like just sitting in conversation. But it's also completely different and inventive way to bring the viewer into an idea. That's what I really love about After Sun and Past Lives as well. It's like it's really exploring like a specific crossroads in life. So with Past Lives, it's having to reckon with the fact that you made decisions and you can't go back in time and you can't romanticize what could have been. Like, you have to live the life you're living. And After Sun is like kind of approaching that crossroads, where she's really thinking about like this trip on her birthday with her own family in tow. Like, she has to come to terms with that trip and what was happening with her dad, and accept that there are things that can't be answered. I think all this stuff just really speaks to a lot of stuff you start thinking about when you're this age. Like, I'm thinking of when Sophie's lying in bed and saying to her dad, like, you ever get to the end of a day and you just like, oh, like your bones feel heavy and like you can't move. And Callum sitting there just like, yeah, kid, like, you have no idea how much I understand that. Like, that's how I feel. Like, I was like, yeah, that's just something you got to get used to. And you got to understand that they're just like, it's an interesting dynamic, because this movie, I'm sure we'll talk about it, like, age is such a huge part of it.
Yeah.
And this idea of Sophie, you know, she's young and the world is so big, and she's getting old, and getting old feels like so huge and like forever. So all she does is have questions about everything. But Callum, like, he's 30 something. He's about to be 31 in the movie, and life feels suffocating. You know, life feels like it's dragging on, and he has less questions about life and is more just like tired of the questions. And that's just like that specific feeling is just something I think perfectly captures people of our age, like something you start to realize about life and start to feel. And I just think that's an incredible thing to capture in this medium.
Yeah, 1,000%. And especially some of the, what's curious is that it's not just the father-daughter experience, but we see a little bit of the twist in that initially Sophie is so curious about boys.
Right.
Later when we see adult her, that she's in a very different relationship, like with a woman, and has a kid with her, and you're like, oh, there's a change that happened at some point in her life, and we're just seeing some of the early stages of a curiosity and like a blossoming sexuality. And just because that's what was going on then doesn't necessarily mean that her life isn't going to evolve in different ways. And it's curious to see the seeds of that being planted and seeing where it goes. Hmm. I thought that was a really nice twist in a way.
Yeah. I like that. I like the sentiment attached to that specific bit of exploration, because I think when you reflect on something, on an experience that was this transformative, like thinking about the last time you saw your dad, I think it's inevitable to, as you're reflecting on the specific memory, you think about everything that was happening, which is what this movie's doing, every little thing. And in that way, the experience becomes even more transformative, because you remember, it's the first time you were exposed to gay love. It's the first time you saw this or that. And in that way, it has an even more profound effect on you and cuts your innocence maybe a little more quickly. Like, it really exposes you to something and becomes even more transforming. I just think that's a cool idea, that because she's forced to reflect on this experience, she reflects on these things that are very much a part of her now in a way that you never would. Like, things that reshape you happen all the time, but they just go by and you probably don't even notice it. But in this instance, you can't stop thinking about it.
Yeah, it's a fascinating coming of age story as both a young girl or a young person at 11 years old, right? And then a coming of age story in your 30s. I feel like every decade has its own coming of age component to it.
Totally.
Where you realize this is what this decade is. And I feel like most movies tend to be about one period of that. So you have the teenager coming of age story. You have the 20-something coming of age story. You have the 30-something coming of age story. Vanilla Sky strikes me as kind of the 20s, early 30s coming of age story. Same with American Psycho in some ways. Fight Club as well as that 20 to 30 coming of age story. But to have both done in one movie through the same character is kind of fascinating. I like how the club scene is handled, the existential rave, because I think we get the idea that Callum loved dancing, right? Mm-hmm. And you can kind of maybe just make the attachment to the rave to her knowing that her dad liked to dance. But I think it also, there's a little bit of the intimation I got, or the subtext that I took away, was that Sophie had started to understand that her dad was so tired on that trip because he was going out at night. That was one of the reasons why he was so tired all the time, was that they would go back to the room, she would go to bed, and he would go out and continue to drink, party, dance, or do whatever. There was something more he was up to that she wasn't privy to at the time. And the first time she realized that maybe something more was going on was when she stayed out later. And when she came back to the room, she couldn't get in. And we know that he went out. We don't see what he did aside from when he went to the beach and jumped in the water. And the implications of that were just the way that the sound of the waves intensified in that scene and just became completely crashing was so well done. But I feel like there's maybe a little bit of a connection to the fact that he was still trying to party, still trying to go do some stuff. And that's why she maybe thinks about the afterlife for him being this rave, because it was this idea of what he was going and doing that she wasn't privy to at all and had no concept of.
Yeah. Yeah. You mentioned a couple of things there I want to touch on. First of all, I don't know if we mentioned this in the Past Lives episode, but part of what makes the whole exploration of thinking about the past and what your life could have been, that's inherently, that is something that speaks to people our age. I guess it could speak to anybody, any age. I'm just thinking that, I know it's something I've definitely gone through at this age, and it's something I was really reflecting on, thinking about the filmmaker being the same age as me. But it was especially interesting that it was an immigration story as well. So it puts a unique perspective on it. It really, it's just something I love about A24 is that they are really giving a voice to people that are taking these classic storylines and ideas and bringing in a new perspective to them. Like it really does make me realize how much I've seen the same kind of story done by a white dude. Like all my favorite filmmakers are white dudes, and I've watched a lot of movies because, like, you know, that's all we can make movies for a long time. And like, these are the kinds of people that explored these subjects. And it's why I think Past Lives and After Sun feel so unique and refreshing, is that it brings a little twist to it. Like, so immigration being part of thinking about your past and wanting to move on from like who you were in literally another place where the rules were different and things were different to like who you are now. And then here, a gay perspective, thinking about your past and like what shaped you and what helped you move along more quickly, what comforted you when you were trying to figure life out. Like, there's just these really interesting perspectives to bring to this material that I, you know, as I'm watching it, like I feel like I'm just learning so much more about people and ways of handling this kind of existential trauma that people have, you know?
Yeah, it's refreshing. Like, yeah. I mean, just even thinking about Barbie as another of the big sure. movie, like Barbie and Bottoms. This is what, 4 podcast episodes in a row that we've covered from female filmmakers this year. And all the movies are so unique, so good, so interesting, and so refreshing.
Mm-hmm.
I hadn't thought about that. That's so cool.
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that either.
You know what movie this also reminded me of in some ways, even though it's a little more positive?
Mm-hmm.
But just from the young character kind of wrestling with their like reaching puberty and sexuality and looking to an older family figure and trying to come to terms with what they're seeing from that, Fat Girl.
Oh yeah. Wow, I gotta watch that again.
Which I'm just now realizing that the French title's To My Sister, is insane. Like, why is it called, how did it go from like To My Sister to Fat Girl?
That is odd.
That's so much like what?
Weird American marketing, I guess.
Yeah, in English-speaking countries, it says the alternative titles were For My Sister and Story of a Whale. Wow.
Huh.
But Catherine Brulotte, that's how you say Brulotte, yeah. Right? This came out on my birthday in Berlin. That's such an interesting movie of this younger girl who has a slightly older, like, pretty sister who is sexually active, and the younger sister trying to process what that means for
right.
her and her emotions around it. And it's very observational and thoughtful, not just about coming of age, but what does it mean to be like a teenage girl, which is also contrasted with the story of the mom. And if I remember the mom having kind of a difficult time, and you get kind of 3 eras of the female experience and what that's saying about the experience with such a dramatic ending.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of the most shocking twist endings of any movie I've ever watched. I don't want to ruin it for anybody that hasn't watched it, but it's just one of those movies that stuck with me for so long. And I always think, will I ever see another movie like it? And I feel After Sun, while it doesn't go off in the direction that, I'm just going to call it To My Sister does from now on. There is something similar about Sophie's curiosity and perspective and the way in which she's observing her father and learning from him, but also breaking away from him. And observing other people her age and slightly older. I really love that aspect.
Yeah. Yeah, it's and none of that would really work unless, again, you feel very part of the environment. It's interesting because, you know, we talk about past lives, and past lives is very intimate. You constantly feel like you're creeping around the corner and like staring at these two people, and you shouldn't be hearing this conversation. Like, it kind of has that energy that you're there. Where After Sun, while intimate and like while you're in it, like, it's maybe it's just like the outdoor setting of the movie and the use of sound. That's one thing I wanted to note that you mentioned, like the waves crashing. It's such an interesting take on sound throughout the movie. They such careful thought was clearly put into that, and like what you're hearing while things are happening. Because, like, you know, you get to this wonderful place, it's supposed to be vacation, birds chirping, wind flowing through trees, and that's all those sounds are happening and very prominent and just like normal moments. But then you can also very heavily hear that stuff during the very emotionally trying moments, like when Colm's crying in bed, to have like those sounds kind of like overpowering what his crying. It's just such an interesting way to approach sound. And in that way, you constantly feel so present in this place. Even though I think it's interesting that, because something like Past Lives, where like we're always like with them and so close, and it feels small, After Sun feels big. It feels vast in a lot of empty space. It's an interesting tension there that's created, that like you feel part of it, yet you feel distant from them at the same time.
Yeah, that space does, the ways in which it plays with distance, like the scene that jumps to mind is when you have Sophie singing Happy Birthday to Colm. Or not Happy Birthday, but for He's a Jolly Good Fellow.
Right.
Which
is how they roll in the United Kingdom, I believe.
Yeah, I had no idea. It took me by surprise. I guess what this was also supposed to be, like, the early 90s.
Yeah, for sure.
So maybe Happy Birthday? I don't know. But it's, there's that distance in just like, not just the father and daughter in that moment, literally as he's climbing up and she's staying down and doing this nice thing, but that creates that sense of distance between them, between the viewer. We don't really see his reaction in that moment. We just get kind of that distant shot of him. And we don't really see her reaction to his. And then you cut to him crying.
Yeah.
And that's just so well done, that sense of space and distance, which is then juxtaposed with the moments where, you know, they're holding hands or she has her head on his shoulder. And the camera isn't afraid to zoom in on those moments or be closer in those moments to really highlight the intimacy. But that dynamic range that comes in visually is so good, and something that I think is missing. A weird comparison, but I get so annoyed at the Lord of the Rings movies because I feel like we don't get enough of that dynamic range. It's too steeped in the medium shot consistently, that I don't get the sense of place or presence in a scene that I would like.
Yeah. I mean, you're totally right. That is very purposely done in this movie. And it's very important for, again, you're noting just the inherent tension that comes with having both of those senses of space at play. It really speaks to the fact that, like, even when, like, we're in these intimate moments where Sophie's able to look back and remember something, like, very specific with her dad, this closeness, there are just as many moments where, like, there's distance and, like, you don't understand things. Like, when Colm's standing up on that ledge and watching these people seeing He's a Jolly Good Fellow to him, like, and he's just taking it in, she's able to then think, like, well, he probably went on the inside. He was crying. He wanted to cry. Like, and that's why we cross cut between that and him crying. It's, that birthday song scene is, it makes me think of, like, right before that, he was doing meditation, or he's doing Tai Chi with Sophie. You know, he's doing meditation and Tai Chi. It's just all about kind of pushing reality away and, like, focusing on the moment. It seems he is desperate to do that, to forget that he's aging, that he's just consumed by life and is having trouble dealing with it. And moments like that where he's people are singing happy birthday to him, he's exposed. You know, it's the opposite of what he wants. He doesn't want to get on stage and sing karaoke. And Sophie doesn't realize any of these things until later in life when she understands that, like, yeah, sometimes you don't want to be the center of attention and you need some time alone and all that.
Yeah, it's so brutal because he talked about how unseen it seemed he was as a kid, like with people forgetting his birthday, his parents specifically forgetting his birthday, and then like going to get a toy. You could tell that there's just like degrees of shame and guilt that he's feeling, one from just his childhood, it seemed, but also with maybe issues with her mom or just not being able to have created that traditional family that she would have liked, and then not able to be around her all the time, and then also not having money to provide for everything. So everything's just a little bit lower in quality and experience than what he would want to give. There's this sense of guilt that's been building up over time, especially with getting her locked out of the hotel room because he went to go party. And the guilt that he's feeling from that. And then to have her get everybody to sing happy birthday. And to have this, like, his child who loves him so much and wants to make him happy, when you feel like you haven't had that from anybody in your life.
Right.
And you feel alone, you feel depression, you feel guilt. Instead of feeling grateful for that, he just feels even shittier. Like he had failed her, doesn't deserve her. It's so crushing because she's just trying to do something to make him happy. And it works, but also because of what he's dealing with, it just exacerbates everything.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it really just speaks to like how fucking hard it is to talk about shit.
Yeah.
That is something you realize. You know, I did just finish up doing therapy for a couple of years, and it was the first time I talked about so many things. He's definitely in a state that I totally understand, where things are happening. You keep marching forward. You keep like getting through the day, like maybe not even thinking about how bad things are or just hoping things get better. But at some point it all falls on you and you realize like shit is not good. And that you need to do something to fix it. Being stuck in that state until then, and when you just feel overwhelmed, like it's heavy. Like I think this movie, just the general mood and feel and tenor of it, like captures that feeling, and captures that feeling in a moment where, when Sophie grows up, and I assume this is Charlotte Wells kind of coming through the screen at that moment, like. This is you feeling that, like, and you having to deal with it and make sense of it all. Finally, it's you just don't know what to do, really.
Yeah. How do you deconstruct all of that, and how do you internalize it or externalize it or be okay with it and move past it? Can you move past it? Should you move past it?
That's the great thing about the movie, is like there actually is not an answer to that question, really. Like you're going to think there, you're going to have different answers to the same questions all the time. You're going to feel differently. You're going to suddenly be overtaken by something you thought you had recovered from. It's just how life works. And I find it very refreshing in that way, that the movie doesn't have answers and doesn't feel the need to give answers. And instead kind of steeps in the reality that like life's hard and you just have to keep marching forward as you slowly figure things out.
Very much so. And it's like, it's such a brutal, like, love letter to those who can't, and such a wonderful, statement to those who do. It's a wonder for a movie to be able to walk that line.
Yeah.
It's making me tear up thinking about it. So I get why this movie has resonated with so many people, either because they've been Sophie or they've been Callum or both.
Right.
And it's a beautiful thing to be able to have something like this conveyed through art that doesn't just turn it into melodrama, but that's mature enough, thoughtful enough, artistic enough to say so much without making a definitive statement that maybe reduces the actual conversation.
It would totally reduce it. I agree.
The one other little subtle thing that I really loved about the movie was the use of music as...
Oof, you got me, Chris. I was ready to talk about this.
I mean, especially like Losing My Religion, there are things that are said in the lyrics. I should have written them down, but the lyrics apply to Callum in that moment.
Mm-hmm.
And then with Under Pressure specifically as well, there are things that are expressed in that, especially just the idea of like Callum is feeling pressure. And you get that with the rug as well. He spends that $850 on the rug to feel like he can, to like have this thing, because sometimes you just make the irrational decision hoping that it'll work out, but you just know that that's going to put even more of a financial crunch on him, which is just going to add to the pressure he's feeling. So like the use of music is something that I think, even if people are giving this movie like a very thoughtful look on first watch, when you go back, really pay attention to the use of song lyrics.
Yeah. I mean, because I wrote the movie guide for this, I know I read about people asking Charlotte Wells about Losing My Religion and about Under Pressure and like why she chose those songs, because you're totally right. Like people, including myself, dig into the lyrics and like, oh, what connections can be made. And the refreshing thing is that she, you know, she says, I didn't even think about using Under Pressure when I picked it. You know, there was no real reason. I just knew it had to be the song. And I think that speaks to the inherent power of the movie, that of course there's probably some subconscious reason she picks Under Pressure. And of course it applies to the scene, but it also doesn't need to apply to the scene. The fact that it just works well aesthetically really brings out the power of the scene, and in this moment where she's like remembering somebody who's not there anymore and she wishes she could reach through and make this connection but can't, like that song's all conveying those emotions. Losing My Religion is like definitely conveying a lot of stuff Callum couldn't say to her. It's just inherent, and that those kinds of songs, you know they just work when the vision for the movie is intact and everything's clicking and it fits into the scene because you've set up this and that, and it pays off in this way from what you're going to learn. It just goes to show you how well the movie is put together.
Really, it really does. I was laughing at the idea of like Charlotte Wells being like, oh, I hadn't thought about it, when it's like specifically the lyrics about like, this is our last dance.
Yeah,
when we're seeing them dancing, it's like, well, you thought about it a little bit, like,
yeah, right.
It wasn't just a coincidence that you had "This is our last
dance." That's what she says
going on, but the larger implications of Under Pressure, I'm sure. But as you said, it's one of my favorite topics: the authorial intent and death of the author dynamics, and how heated people get either way.
Oh yeah, I'm well aware.
Yeah, some people really love like authorial intent, and other people are just like complete death of the author. It doesn't matter what they say. I tend to fall into both. Like, I think it can be helpful to have an idea of what they were going for and what they're saying. Like when we did our piece on the Wailing, we did a podcast on the Wailing.
Yeah, we did.
Yeah. I don't think we talked about the origin of the movie in that, or did the quotes of the origin of the movie, but the director had lost a few close friends through like tragic circumstances.
Mm.
They weren't like just natural causes.
Yeah.
And that made him start reflecting, especially as somebody who is religious, on why this would happen. Like, what is it that these larger forces are trying to say or do to take the lives of these people that you care about? And he translated that into The Wailing. And you can see how that does set up the larger, like, forces that are at play in that movie that are beyond the understanding of humans, which is cool. But without the authorial, like, intent there, you may not necessarily get that, but you also do get that if you just analyze the movie. Right. So it's a very fascinating conversation for me all the time. So I'm glad that there's Charlotte Wells talking about it, because I haven't gotten to dive into it yet.
Yeah. No, it's yeah, people do get heated. It's, you know, it's I agree with you. It's good to have both. I think about the fact that, you know, all of our articles on our site are labeled with the definitive explanation, and that conveys this idea that this is it. Like, this is how you understand the movie. That's not really true. I mean, we put that title on there because we are trying to be that. We're trying to give you as much information as we can to be like, all right, like, here's how you could think of the movie. Here's like all these pieces that worked well together. This is what the movie's trying to say. But from there, there are a million conversations you can have about a movie. You know, somebody with a very specific experience could take something completely different away from a movie. And that's really the beauty of having these conversations and becoming part of these articles that we write, like commenting and just keeping it open-ended that, okay, yeah, like, this might have been done for this reason, but that's not the end of the story. Like, we can go on from there in so many different directions.
Oh, yeah, 1,000, especially when you just start putting things into frames. Like, as much as we want to say, like, oh, this is the definitive, you can always just be like, oh, how do I analyze this movie in terms of, you know, childhood? And just saying that, even if it's about something like a movie is not related to childhood, like, I don't know, Full Metal Jacket. You know, there's still frames that you can put on a movie and look at it through that open up new levels of conversation and discussion. I mean, that was something that happened with Fight Club in recent years, especially in like the 2010s. People have started putting it through different social lenses and conversation points that go beyond just the male experience of the movie.
Right.
And looking at it from those other angles and discussion points, and it completely opens it up from whatever the film's initially doing to just the way that we do with art. Like, every work can be put in different contexts. Like, you could look at Frankenstein, the original Frankenstein book, and put it in the context of post-atomic age science concerns. You could put it into like sexuality concerns. You can put it into like economic concerns. Like, you can reframe it in all these different ways. That's the beauty of art. But then there's also some of the more like core definitive conversation points.
Yeah. Yeah. We like both.
We like both. Can't we like both?
Yeah. Give us a break.
Anything like any scene that you loved, anything that you didn't like?
I love the music. I loved hearing Chumbawamba. I loved hearing the Macarena. Really took me back. yeah, this and Bottoms, that's two movies in a row. I'm like, man, the music is just kick ass. there's just a lot that I love in this movie. I think the scene where Sophie's laying in bed and telling her dad about her bones feeling heavy and all that, like, that scene just hit me a lot more than it did before. I don't know why it didn't stick out in my memory last time, but now it's the one I can't stop thinking about.
Nice.
How about you?
I really like the subtle ways that the movie explores Callum's hypocrisy. I thought that was kind of interesting. Like, he makes Sophie do water polo. He makes Sophie, you know, dance when she doesn't want to. But when she tries to do the same thing and bring the same energy with getting him to come in karaoke, he won't do it.
Yeah.
And there's just like the little ways in which he's wonderful, but also hypocritical or negative, and that the movie manages to have those pros and cons all wrapped up in very nuanced, subtle ways with the character. It really adds just a dimensionality to it that I really loved.
Especially when you know that Sophie's putting it together so many years later, like, yeah, my dad probably didn't want to sing this specific song in front of a bunch of people he doesn't know.
Yeah. And what was the, I really like just a small moment, but where he has the washcloth over his face.
Mm-hmm.
And it's such an intense close-up that you can't really make out what's going on. Mm-hmm. But it's just from the fabric going in and out and the sound of the breath so loud that really tells you, okay, I think this is someone with a washcloth over their face.
It did look bizarre. Like, it felt like a horror movie for a second.
Yeah. Mm. Oh, good movie. Ranking. Ranking. Yeah. I forgot about that.
Yeah, let's do it. So we rank every movie we watch, starting in... my list goes a little further back, starting at the beginning of 2022. Chris's was started around like June or July.
July, yeah.
You think I would remember it by now?
Getting closer.
So my list is a little bit longer. I also have no life and watch a lot more movies. So my list right now is up to 448 movies.
Whoo!
And I have After Sun at number 153, so top third.
Okay, it's pretty good.
Yeah, it's a movie I really like. I have a lot of strong connections to it. I think maybe the only thing, not to compare, keep comparing it to Past Lives, because like, why? I don't know why I would even compare it to Past Lives. But thinking of Past Lives, I think one thing that I like about that kind of movie more, I really like being in it with the character. I like that sense of I guess I don't know how to describe it. It feels so assured and realized in a way. I guess maybe this is the way I can put it. I like when my hand's held in a movie. Like, I kind of like that feeling. I like being intimate and being there with people. Where After Sun, while I really enjoy it and I loved writing about it and piecing it together, like, it's not exactly like my favorite kind of movie. Again, making me sound stupid, I don't necessarily want to have to do a lot of work to like a movie. And I don't think that's necessarily true about this movie. I think a lot of it works by having to do work, which is why I have it, I think, pretty high on my list. It's up there with movies I love. But I don't have that kind of connection I have with it like I would of something like Past Lives.
Yeah, I get that. I have it, I'm not sure of the placement currently. I might adjust it up. Actually, I have it at 36 right now. It's in my like tier 3 category.
Okay.
Impressive.
So, out of how many movies?
Oh, 157.
Okay. So top like fifth, pretty good.
Yeah, it's up there. I have it weirdly placed between Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, Mutant Mayhem, and Spider-Man Across the Spider-Verse. But below, like, I have it currently below Drive and Knives Out, which I don't know if that's going to stick. Like, I could see it going above both. Drive is just a little more, like, thrilling to me, but I could see the emotionality of After Sun winning out. And Knives Out, it's something where maybe the entertainment value, like, I think After Sun is a better movie, but in terms of just like entertainment value on rewatch, like, I think I might opt to rewatch Knives Out a little more often than After Sun.
Hmm. Do you want to hear my After Sun sandwich?
Yeah.
All right. So on top, the top bun, the sesame bun, is licorice pizza. Then the cheese that would be on the burger that is After Sun, or tofu, whatever you put on your sandwich is fine. Frenzy, the Alfred Hitchcock, I think it was the second to last movie he made. He got really crazy with that one. He had like brutal murders in that one in a way that, you know, and people in his movies, like as an old timey movies, like you never saw them die. You know, they would like die off screen, or like it would be so G-rated or something. He gets really crazy in Frenzy. And then below After Sun, I don't know, on a sandwich, like on a burger, I'm the kind of person that puts all of the like lettuce, tomato, condiments, I put it below the burger. Do you do that?
No, I do them all above the burger.
All above. Yeah, I used to do that, but then like I saw somebody do it another way once and I started doing it. I was like, oh, this is the way to do it. Anyway, there I have Megan. Or M3gan, whatever you choose to call it.
M3gan.
It followed by Mamma Mia, Here We Go Again.
Wow, that is I can't tell if that's more bizarre than the ones I have in between or not.
It is a pretty weird look. That's a pretty good representation of my movie taste, though.
Yes, it is.
Those are all so different.
Very much so. Wow. Okay. Well, After Sun. I'm like very excited to see what Charlotte Wells does next.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
I will be there opening weekend.
And Paul Mescal. I mean, that guy's about ready to blow up.
Yeah, he crushed it.
He's great. Like,
that was
everybody's great in this movie.
What does he have coming up? God's Creatures, Carmen,
Gladiator,
All of Us Strangers. Oh yeah, he was casting Gladiator.
Can't wait.
That's right. And then Foe, is that one I'm interested in?
That's Saoirse Ronan.
Yeah. Okay, that'll be cool. And then what's Frankie doing?
I don't know. She is great, though. I really, not easy to do, but like just captured how a kid talks.
Yeah.
Like just kind of babbling, you know, and like thinking they're saying something smart when they aren't.
Yeah. There were some moments where I was just like, how do you act that?
I completely agree. I was very impressed.
She's starring in a movie called The Bagman, where she plays Emily. And that's in post-production.
I wonder if it's a sequel to the Friday the 13th movies, because I don't know if you've ever seen them, Chris, but in the second movie, the killer wears a bag over his head.
I did not know that.
Doesn't get the mask until I think the third movie.
I need to watch all of those. I don't think I've ever watched a full Jason movie.
You should watch the first one for sure. The first one's awesome.
Yeah, I remember people talking about it. It was always one of those like things in high school and college. People were like, do you know who the killer is in the first Jason movie?
Because the killer does change in the movies.
Yeah. The Bagman, do you want to hear the description?
Yeah.
Patrick fights his deepest fear when a sinister threat from his childhood returns to haunt him. So, maybe.
Is this threat's named Jason?
We'll see.
Okay, we're ready to wrap it up on set, right?
Yeah. What are we doing next?
Oh yeah, I do believe, and we're sure of this time. I think we're doing Donnie Darko next.
Yeah, we've just talked about it for a month now. I think it's next.
And I just watched it, so we have to.
Okay, beautiful. Then Donnie Darko, it is.
All right. So everybody, we're gonna get ready to go home. Lights,
camera.
See ya. I almost said action. I had to take a second.
One of these days, we'll be on time.